Yeah, right, but it's confitoria. Confitoria.
Confitoria.
Yeah, so it's based on the French, right. Yeah. Okay. So, in worshipping the Egel Hazav, the Jews showed that, that they had a certain yearning for Aved Zorah. V'chiyosu ovdei kechovim, shlichusu didhu ovdei. So, when the idolaters came to Eretz Yisrael, they were only following a Jewish penchant for it, right? So, Hochinami, so likewise it says, Yisrael shezorkat levenot, a Jew who puts up a brick, then God Yodate the Nichole Baveris Kechovim. So he reveals that in his, he likes the idea of an idol. V'chiyoso Eved Kechovim Eforachlo, right? So when the goy comes along and actually worships it, so Shlechuso Didei Kovit, then the goy is actually serving as, a shaliach. The Jew, he's doing the mission of the Jew. So they say the Dilma the Eagle who the Nicholahu, but the Midiach we know. No. And if you might think that okay, the Jews were willing to worship the Eagle Hazahav, but they wouldn't want to worship any other kind of an idol, right? So Omar Kro, so that's why the Torah says in connection with the Egel Hazov, it says, Ela Elohecho Yisrael, these are your gods, O Israel, right? Melamed, which teaches us, She'ivul Elohus Harbe, they really desire many different deities. So Ema called the Bahade Egel Nitzaru. So we could say that all those asherim, right, all those trees that were dedicated to Avodah Zorah, right, they were prohibited at the time of the Eretz Yisrael, nishtaru, right, but after that they would be permitted. So man muchar. So what are you trying to prove over here? What can you prove? Okay, who knows what took place at that particular time when they worship. But it's obvious that what? That a Jew should not be worshipping Avodah Zorah, and the Goy doesn't really give up unless he actually, you can see physical damage that he does, and that, he simply throws aside his idol and doesn't want to have any more to do with it. Okay. Okay, tonight is the 20th of December, the year 2006, beginning of Rosh Chodesh Teves, Chanukah, sixth night of Chanukah, and we are gathered here to continue the study of the Gemara Avodah Zorah, Nun Gimel Amud Beis, for the new Mishnah. Okay. Now, you recall the previous Mishnah that we discussed dealt in general with how you, for example, deface an idol and who is permitted, to declare the idol null and void, and we discover it was the goy. But if it's a Jew, then in that particular case the Jew has no authority to make an idol null and void. It's not his. Not allowed to do it, so he has to have his friendly goy do it. And then we discussed certain things that they did as a sign, that they no longer have any faith in their idol, and they consider that it's nothing at that point. As for example, if they chipped off a piece of the idol or something like that, we discussed with the nose, fingers, whatever it may be, and so on. And in that particular case, it shows that they don't believe in it anymore. As far as the wars that were waged by Joshua, there already is a different problem. Did the idolaters give up on their idolatry when they were conquered or not? And we discovered that they really did not give up on their idolatry. And so this continued to be a problem for the people of Israel, who were attracted And as we spoke about the attraction of idolatry to Jews, you know, in the last couple of weeks or so, we were talking about it, as witnessed the the present holiday season, which was not only Hanukkah, which is predominating our thoughts, but unfortunately our thoughts are being invaded by the general holiday atmosphere that we're currently living through at this time of the year. Okay, so now the new Mishnah continues, first of all, with an idea which is related to that. The question is, Avodas Kechovim She'enichuha Uvedeha. Let's say you find an idol which has been left behind by its worshipper. So Bishar Shalom Muteris. If it is a time of peace, then in that particular case, obviously if he left it behind, it means that he has no desire anymore in order to come back to it. So that therefore this is also a way of you know, of being mavatal, of nullifying it as an idol. But if it's Bishas Milchama, however it happens to be in a time of war, then Asura, then it is prohibited to a Jew. Why is it prohibited? Because obviously if the Goy was forced to leave it behind, he still has hopes of coming back. He still wants to worship it when he has the chance to do it. So that therefore it still is an idol. Then the next part of the Mishnah deals with the following. Bimusuyos shel melochim. Bimus has various meanings in the Gemara language. Of course, it's really based upon a Greek word, bimus, which means like a platform. This, and incidentally, what do we have in the shul that's based on the same word? Bima. No question about it. It comes from that Greek word too, you see. So these were pedestals. Alright. Now what kind of pedestals were they? The answer is that they were a stone pedestal upon which they would place a statue of the king. If the king was in town or something like that, then they wanted to show honor to him, so what did they do? They put, let's say, a bust of the king on top of this pedestal. Alright. So now the question is, what happens if there is no bust of the king upon the pedestal? I mean, it's just a stone, right? This is the situation. So in that case it says, Hare Elu Mutoris, they are permitted, Mipnei Shema Amidin Oysa Bishar Shablochim Ovid, because they put the bust of the emperor over there. And remember that, again, we discussed time and again that in the idea of the Roman world, the emperor was considered like a god. Okay? So, when the king is going by over there, then they put it on. But if they take it off, that means that, you know, it's not there on a permanent basis, obviously. Okay? So this is what the Mishnah says. Okay. So, first part of the Gemara deals with the following. It says, Omar Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah said, Omar Rav, in the name of Rav, he said it. It says, Beis Nimrod, Harei hi kavidus kechovim shedichuha ovdeho. Bishar Shalom, he says. The Beis Nimrod, what does it mean by the Beis Nimrod? Literally, the house of Nimrod. So who is Nimrod? We know that in the Bible, you know, that Nimrod is mentioned as being a great warrior, a great hunter. Okay, this is why incidentally there are hunter societies, and that they use the word Nimrod, you know, in connection with it. Okay, but from the point of view of the Agarata, and you know, the Agarata is all the various stories that were carried orally in connection with the Torah. So Nimrod was the king at the time of what we call the Dor HaPlaga. What is the Dor HaPlaga? Dor HaPlaga is that generation where all the languages were split. Naturally, what was the occasion? It was the building of the Tower of Babel. Okay, so that this is what we mean over here, that the Tower of Babel, right, Obviously, it was originally the idea is, you know, to establish like an Avodah Zarah over there. They wanted to make war against the Rebbeinu Shalom, if you remember. That's why they built it, right? So, right now, it's been deserted. It's lying someplace, I don't know, in Iraq or someplace or other today, if they still have it. But what about it? Does it still have any sanctity? So he says, inasmuch as the people who worshipped it as a temple, they left it behind, they scattered to all parts of the world, and this was not at a time of war, but it was in a time of peace. So obviously they felt that it's not important to them anymore, and so they mevatel it as an Avodah Zarah. So this is why it says that is right now Harehi Kavodes Kechovim Shenichuchov Deho Bishar Shalom, right? It's like an idol that the worshipper simply left it behind in a time of peace, Ubutor, and therefore is permitted. Afogav Tchi Badrinu Rachmoda. All right. Right now, even though what made these people scatter? It was the Rebbeinu Shalom. Rachmanas, you know, the Rebbeinu Shalom. The Rebbeinu Shalom scattered them. So you might consider it as what? Shas milchama dovei. It would be similar as if it were a time of war. Right? So how could we say that it was Bishas Shalom and so on? That's the question, right? So, the answer is, if they really had desired to come back to it, they would have come back. So, but inasmuch as they didn't come back, then we have to say, bituli betola. I mean, they simply, you know, they mavatled it, they nullified it, it was no longer important to them. Okay, so now we come to the next part of the Mishnah. The bimasuyos shel melochim tarei elibutolis, right? That these stone pillars, pedestals upon which they would put a bust of the king or the emperor, they are permitted when obviously the bust is not there. So they say, v'chim mipnei shemabidin oisa b'shosh ha-melochim opin b'torin. All right, inasmuch as they set it up only when the kings go by that particular road, so therefore mutaran, we say they are permitted when obviously the king is not over there. Okay. Malachim, I skipped something. Okay. Yeah, right, because my eye ran down a line. Okay. So, Omar Rabbi Barachon, Rabbi Barachon said, Omar Rabbi Yochel, the name Rabbi Yochel, he says, Chokikoma. This is really what he understands by the Mishnah. It says, Mipnei Shema Amidin Hosom Mishav Shamlochim Oivrin, right? Inasmuch, when do they set up and make it into something? It's only when the king goes by. Omar Lachim, Manichin Deresu, Vahultim Derech Acheres. But it's up to the king. They may put it up not just on one road, on Sumner Avenue, maybe they put it up on Belmont Avenue, right? Or the king decided that, in other words, maybe they put it on Sumner and on Belmont, and those that they put up on Sumner, obviously he decided to go on Belmont instead of on Sumner, right? So, that being the case, so obviously, if it was not important to him, they were just doing it, you know, as a show of loyalty to the king, and that's all there is. But they had no intention of making it really into an Avodah Zarah, because did they actually worship anything over there? That's the question. Now, obviously, they didn't worship. They just set it up. That's it. There are people, of course, what is it, Jehovah's Witnesses? They don't believe in a flag or something like that. And so, you know, So what do you do? I remember years ago there was a whole controversy about the kid who was a Jehovah's Witness. He didn't want to say the Pledge of Allegiance. That raised the question at the time. Because today they're trying to get rid of the Pledge of Allegiance and everything else. You know. But the point is that it isn't something, you know, which is actually worshipped. It's only, it's a symbol of something. You see, that's all. So, he also, Ulav, when Ula came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, Yasiv Abisba Pegiba. So he sat down on one of these pedestals, okay, but it was Pegima, it was, you know, spoiled. In other words, it had a crack in it, a hole in the face, or something, but it was not in perfect condition, okay. The Hebrew word today is Pagu. Pegima is the Aramaic, okay. Huh? Okay, Ulo was a great Babylonian scholar, but he studied part of the time in Eretz Yisrael. So, when he came back to Babylonia, he reported, naturally, different teachings that he had heard from his teachers in Eretz Yisrael. Reported them to the scholars in Babylonia. Okay, this is the situation. All right. So, Ula is mentioned hundreds of times in the Gemara. Hundreds of times. Yeah. So, on his way back, he sat on one of these pillars, which was, as I said, a little spoiled. All right. So Amalei Rabbi Yehuda Ula. So Rabbi Yehuda, who was in Babylonia, said to Ula, the whole Rabbish world, the Amen Tavaihu, Bibashin Ifgan Osir, take a look. The great teachers of Babylonia, Rav and Shmuel, both of them are in agreement that a pedestal which is even ruined, right? It's not a perfect pedestal. It's prohibited. In other words, he should not have sat down on it. The Afiel Ulamanda Omar, and even in accordance with the opinion that says, Ein Ovdim Lishvorim, that you do not bow down to broken idols. Remember, we had that quite a few would drop him back if the idol was broken. Whether, you know, and we decided, for example, if it's only a potsherd or something like that, or if it's simply become a piece of clay, something. So it's all right, but if the idol still remains, you know, more or less whole, then it may still be considered an idol or something like that. So at any rate, we learned that there is an opinion that says that it is permitted if it is broken, and another one, you know, that says to the contrary. So they say, even in accordance with the opinion that says that they do not worship broken fragments of an idol, Hani Milei, this is in reference to Avodas Kechovim, this is Bei Milsa, the Miflach. This is in reference to an idol where it's not proper to worship broken pieces of an idol. Aval Hai, but in the case of the Bimos, in the case of the pedestal, Loret Pasle, what difference does it make unto him? Doesn't care about it. So therefore, according to Rav and Shmuel, it should be prohibited, what Ula did, sitting on it, right? So Amalei, so he said to him, I man yoiv lod me afro the Rav and Shmuel, I would that we would be able to have once more the very dust of Rav and Shmuel, and they would enlighten our eyes. In other words, Rav and Shmuel are now gone, but if we only had them in our midst today, their teachings in our midst today, then we could learn something. And what is he referring to? It says, Ho Rabbi Yochanan v'Reish Lakish. Both Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, incidentally, were in Eretz Israel, not in Babylonia, but the Amri Tavaihu, who say both of them, Bimu Shenifgam Mutar, that a pedestal which is ruined is permitted for use. V'afilu l'man d'omar, Ovdin Nishvorim. And even in accordance with the opinion of the person who says that idolaters still bow down to a broken piece of an idol, but it's Hane Mila Averis Kekhovim. Yeah, this is true if it is an idol. Why? The Keva and the Palcha, because once they worship it, then Zilabe Milsim, then in that case, they are not inclined to want to annul it. Aval Hane. But in our case over here, it says, Shakle Lahai, Maisa Bir Misachina. They don't like this pedestal, they'll go and set up a different pedestal. I mean, if it's ruined or something like that. So that therefore, they'll replace it simply with a different one, because it's pastish for the king, you know, to have a broken pedestal, and then there's his bust, and so on, so that therefore, the broken pedestal itself has no significance whatever, and therefore Ulo was right in doing what he did. Okay, this is what they're trying to prove. Okay, Tanya Karvosi de Rabbi Yochanan Le Shlokish. We've learned the Baraisa, which is along the same lines as the idea of Rabbi Yochanan Le Shlokish, namely Bimus She Nifgam Mutor, that a pedestal which has become broken down is permissible to do whatever you want with it. But Mizbeach Shenifkam, however, an altar which has come into ruins, in other words, in this case, of course, it would be the altar of an idol, right? It was used in order to worship the sacrifice animals or whatever rites they're performing to it, then in that case it is prohibited ad shenitotzeis rubo, until the point where most of the mizbeach is broken down into pieces. Only then might it become so. How about the mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash? What did we learn about that, if you remember? If the Mizbeach and the Beis HaMikdash were broken, can it be replaced? The answer is yes. But what do you do with the Mizbeach in order to make sure that they have to bury it? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is what we learned that they had to do in the case of many of the things. When King Yoshiyahu saw that the Jewish kingdom was about to fall to the Babylonians, he wanted to safeguard the most holy objects in the Beis HaMikdash. So what did he do? So he buried them. This is why the Ark was buried, Noah was buried, so on and so forth. And they used instead, replicas for the time being. But the actual thing, the most holy things that came back after the time of the Mishkan, came back from the time when the people of Israel first left Eretz Yisrael, that were things that were put in the place by King Solomon when he dedicated the Beis HaMikdash and so on. The most holy things were buried. So I don't know where the lost ark is today. But going into the tunnel where you go actually into behind the Kotel Ma'aravi, where you go deep down into the earth and you see actually foundations of the Beis HaMikdash that date back right to Solomon's time, and they point out a certain spot over there where they say this was where the Kodesh HaKodoshim faced, the Holy of Holies faced, and so on. So it's quite an experience. The next time you're in Yerushalayim, don't forget to go and see it. Pardon me?
So Ethiopia is a far cry from that.
Yeah, I know, they have a tradition that it was brought to Ethiopia. I have my great doubts about it, but it's a place called El Aqsa or something like that, where they claim they have it. Yeah,
what you're saying?
The Ethiopians have a theory that
Haile Selassie.
Right, that whether it was Haile Selassie or whoever it was, they brought the ark into Ethiopia.
They have the ark.
Yeah.
They claim they have it.
They claim they have it, right. Yeah. I doubt it, but they claim that. Okay. Makes them happy to think so. Gesundheit. Now, the Gemara continues. I mean, we said, you know, a bimos, in other words, a pedestal, as compared to what? To a mizbeach, to an altar. So, heichi domi, what? How do you explain what is a bimos? Heichi domi mizbeach, and how do you explain what is a mizbeach? So, Rav Yaakov Baridi, or Rav Yochanan. So, bimos is even achas. A bimos is only one stone. That's all. They have a big stone that they use as a pedestal, and that's it. Okay? So it's only one. Whereas mizbeach is avodim harbe. An altar consists of many stones. I mean, the altar in the Beis HaMikdash, you know, it had to be of stone, but what else did we learn about it? Not allowed to use iron, if you remember, in hewing the piece of stone had to be natural stone and so on. And why was iron prohibited? We learned because iron, I mean, Rashi's famous explanation, that iron shortens the life of a human being, and the Mizbeach is there in order to bring long life to people, to be a source of welfare to people. So that's why it had to be natural stone and not carved out. Okay, continue now with Dun Dalad, Omen Aleph, Omar Chizkiya. So, Chizkiya said, this is a reference to the Mizbeach. How do we know that the Mizbeach consists of more than one stone? Okay, many stones. So, Chizkiya said, by Krah, what is a pasuk that shows, you know, what I said. He says, Besumo, this is a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Besumo, kolavdei mizbeach, ki avne gir minu potzos, lo yokumu asherim v'chamonim. It says, when they will make all the stones of the altar like stones of chalk broken into pieces, you know, the chalk stone breaks very easily. You ever try, of course, writing with a piece of chalk on the blackboard, you know how easy it breaks. So, the same thing, chalk stone too easily breaks up, okay? So, lo yakumu asherim v'chamonim. Then, in that particular case, neither the asherim nor the chamonim is usually translated as altars to the sun, will not arise. In other words, then, when the stones of the altar are broken into little pieces so that it has no longer any value, whatever, do you understand? Then in that particular case, it's the same. That it means that even the asherim and the chamonim also, if they're broken into pieces, they have no value, whatever. Okay. So, and as Rashi says, lo yakumu means, he says, shuv lo yakruvu alot. Once it's broken, they're never going to worship on it. Okay. And he explains, if taka it is, you know, like stones of chalk which are broken into pieces, then in that particular case, lo yakum asherim v'chamonim. Then in that case, the asherim and the chamonim also will not have any worth in the eyes of the idolater. However, ilav yokumu. Okay, but if not, in other words, if it still remains in one piece, then in that particular case, people will continue to worship over there and also to venerate the asherim, and
the Chamonim, the altars to the sun. So the point is, as we said before, that if it is broken up, then in that particular case it loses its value. So it's like bittul, the same idea. Alright, now the Gemara continues with something which is not mentioned in the Mishnah itself, okay, but it's in line with some of the other things that we've had before. We know that sometimes people would worship a brick. We had that recently. A brick, they set up a brick as opposed to worship. Don't ask me why. It's Mishigas, but they did it, okay? Or they would worship an animal, or something like that, okay? All right. Now, what we have now is in reference to an animal. As Rashi points out, he says, okay, we're talking about living animals, in other words, like a ram, a goat, a sheep, or whatever it may be, right? A bull, you know, which would normally be used as what? It's a sacrifice of the Beis HaMikdash, okay? So, we say now that Tana, we have a teaching which says Ne'evad Shelo Osur Mishel Chaveiro Mutar, which means if the animal was his own and he worshipped it, then in that case it is prohibited. Okay? If it was, however, the animal belonging to his neighbor, then in that particular case it would be permitted. It would be permitted. Why would it be permitted? It would be permitted because we say that you cannot really oyser, you cannot really prohibit something that doesn't belong to you. You can prohibit something that belongs to you. You say, I don't want to use it, or you can make it prohibited by, in this case, worshipping it. Do you understand? But you cannot do it with somebody else's property. That's his, it's not yours, and therefore you can't do it. So it does not lose its sanctity if your neighbor wants to use it as a sacrifice on the base of English. We're talking about using it as a sacrifice. Okay. However, we asked Zalakash about this. Because it says, Ezehu Ne'evad, what do we mean by worshipped? It says, Kol she'ev dinoy say, bein b'shegeg, bein b'mezid, bein b'reinez, bein b'ratzeg. Right? It means whether the animal was worshipped as an idol, right? Whether by error, shegeg, or deliberately, maze it, right? Whether it was done the anus, somebody forced you to do it, or bein baratzeit, or whether you did it of your own free will. Okay, so this says then it is prohibited. First, the Mishnah said that if it belongs to your neighbor, it's permitted, right? And now we say if it's worshipped at all, whether it belongs to you or to your neighbor, it makes no difference whether it was done willingly or against your will, and so on and so forth, right? Done by mistake, whatever. Then, in that particular case, it is now prohibited. So, it's already a contradiction to the previous one. And not only that, you have a problem of onus. Hai onus hechidami. When we say onus means forcing somebody to do something, okay? What case are we talking about? Lav kigon de anas behemas chaveiro ishtachavei lot. Maybe we're talking about a case where he was ones, in this particular case means that he stole the animal from his neighbor. He forced him to give it up, okay? He forced him to do it and to worship it. Okay.
Who stole the moon?
this particular case, it could be either the goy who forced another goy, or it could be a Jew who forced. We don't know. Okay? Obviously, if we're talking about using the animals to sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, then primarily we're talking about a Jew in this particular case. Not that a goy can't bring a sacrifice, but that was done sort of out of goodwill or something like that. And obviously, it was permitted, right?
It was permitted, right?
If a goy wants, I'll tell you why. Take a look at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. So, you know, the first verse says Vayikra Moshe, and then the second verse says Odom ki yakriv mikem korban ad Hashem. Okay, if a human being, Odom, wants to worship, make a sacrifice from among you to God, right? In that case, I mean, he has to give an ola, a burnt offering as his sacrifice. So the very fact that it says Odom means that any person could do it in that particular case. So even non-Jews were permitted to sacrifice if they wanted to do it, you know, willingly, as an offering, as an ola in the Beis HaMikdash. But in most cases, I mean, we were talking about animal sacrifice. We know that we mean the Jews, I mean, who did, let's say, 99.99% of the sacrifices were from Jews, okay? So, he forced his neighbor to give him the animal, right? And is it permissible or not? The answer is no, okay? So, high earnest, right? We said, going to on us bebas chaveru ishtachem, he bowed down to it, okay, and made it into worship, an idol to worship. So, Omar Rami Bar Choma, so Rami Bar Choma says, no, that's not the case. It's kegon she'anasuhu obdei kechovim ishtachevo levhemto. No, the case that we're talking about is he owns an animal, right? Remember where we said that it's prohibited. So he says he owns the animal, and along came the goyim, and they forced him to bow down to the animal, to his own animal. Okay? So Rashi says, I mean, that what we're talking about over here is that we're talking about it at a time when, unfortunately, the goyim forced Jews to do things against their will they didn't want to, okay? And this is part of the persecution of the Jews by the Romans. We know that in the case of Tanaka, which was at the time of the Greeks, you know, people sometimes stress all the importance, you know, about the lights, fighting for freedom, etc., etc. But the truth of the matter is that Antiochus actually had prohibited Jews upon penalty of death from keeping Shabbos, from davening, from circumcision, even from having the Beis Din declare when it's Rosh Chodesh, which when we learned Gemara Rosh Hashanah, remember that this is a very important function of the Beis Din, to declare officially that right now it's Rosh Chodesh, so that people would know what the proper time was in order to observe the various Chagim, various festivals. So there was persecution at that time by the Greeks, under the Greeks, and there was a load of persecution under the Romans, who also prohibited the practice of Judaism because they wanted to destroy the Jewish religion if they could. And of course we know that the Jews were willing to martyr themselves rather than submit to this. But that brings us into the area about martyrdom and about onus. What is onus again? Onus is forcing, right? So he's talking now, according to him, according to Rami Bar Choma, right? He says, the idolaters forced a Jew to bow down to his own animal. In other words, to make it like an idol. Maskiflo Rabbi Zeira. So Rabbi Zeira attacked this by saying, Oynas, Rachmona Patre. We have a general principle in the Gemara in various places that says that Oynas, if a person did something because he was forced to do it, something happened that he was not able to do it of his own free will, then in that particular case, the Ribbono Shel Olam excuses him. Oynas Rachmona Patre. Okay. Yes. The sages then subsequently, right, they came out with a decree to the extent that if a goy forces you to perform one of these three actions, one is Shefichas Damim, he forces you and says to you, you have to kill this other person, otherwise I'll kill you. We must not do it. Same thing, Gilui Arroyos. In other words, a person says, you have to have intercourse with this woman who is prohibited to you. That's also prohibited. Also, he should sacrifice himself and not do it.
Being forced to do it.
Right, being forced. Or, in the third case, it is Aveda Zora. You know, don't bow down to idolatry. And if the goy tries to force you to commit Aveda Zora, then in that particular case,
that
right.
Case.
But then they added a different proviso. That proviso is that if it's something that is in public, then you have to be willing to die rather than perform it. If it is in private that they want you to observe Aveda Zora, I'm not talking about the other two, I mean, which are prohibited.
Right.
But Aveda Zora, that in that particular case, if it's not a public thing, but it's only a private thing, then in that particular case, you're not forced to give up your life in order, not to worship the Aveda Zora. It's a gray area. I don't have to tell you that. Very gray area. But the principle of Oynas Rachmona Patre, it can apply to various situations. Let's say you're in the hospital. You're tied to tubes and everything else. I don't have to tell you, right? It's very difficult to daven over there, particularly if they're giving you sedatives and things like that. Right. So in that case, we say, "Hey, this is Mother Patri." You're under duress at this particular moment. You're not under your own self-control, so the Ribbono Shel Olam will forgive you. All right. Even if, let's say, you were busy doing something and it was impossible to break off in order to daven mincha on time. Okay? So, in that particular case, we say that oynas rachmona patre, but that you have to make up when you have a chance. And how do you make it up? So the answer is, after you daven marav, right, then you say ashrei, and you say shmona esrei as a makeup, and so on, and then aleinu. So, as I say, there are situations where this is a general principle that holds, okay? Now, how do we derive that from the Torah? This is a question. So he says, Dichsiv, what is the pasuk that teaches us this principle? He says, V'lanara le'sase dovor. Okay, here we are talking about a girl, right? Out in the fields, and somebody forces her to have intercourse. Okay, he rapes her, in other words. Okay, now obviously she didn't want it. Of course, we're talking about a Dara Boris. I mean, if she is already engaged to somebody, because Zahra Marasa, it's as if she were already married, even though they haven't yet had the final the chuppah and kedusha and so on and so forth. Okay, they didn't consummate it yet, because remember, back in the days of the Talmud, they used to have two stages. One was Erusin, and the other one was Kiddushin. Erusin means that there was an official betrothal, in which case he... Betrothal. I'm using a fancy English word. A fancy word. Engagement, okay. But it's actually stronger than engagement, because, you know, with an engagement, you have... Today we have, you know, a remnant of that idea, what we call, you know, Schreibtsnoyim, or something like that, or among the Hasidim days, they call it Avot, right? Where you make a promise that, you know, the Chos and the Kala, you know, are going eventually to get married. They wrote a ksuba, and she was his wife. For all purposes, except that they were not living together yet. After they had a chance to build up a house, buy furniture, etc., etc., then they would have the final act, which was kiddush. And, you know, they would move into the house, and then they were allowed to consummate the marriage, and they lived as husband and wife from that point on. So, here we have the Nara Marasa. The girl is already betrothed, right? Now, if she had willingly consented,
that is adultery.
You understand? But this girl did not willingly assent. And this is what the Gemara is saying, quoting the Torah, namely that Nara loves Hasadava. In other words, he, the seducer or the rapist, he was the oinus. He was the oinus. Well, this is the field, because it says that she could cry out, but there's nobody to help her in any way. Because if she were in the city, she was expected to cry out in order to try to get help, you know. But, you know, so in that case, I mean, she's not to be punished in any way. He gets the punishment, but not she. Okay.
What kind of punishment
does he get? He can be put to death.
Yeah?
Yeah, because she was, as I said, she's now an Ashes-ish. She's a married woman. Even though technically she hasn't lived yet with her husband, you understand? But still, she is married officially by virtue of the Erison.
I always wonder about when I study Sota, you know.
Right.
The woman always gets punished, but the boy, if a man is ever caught of is accused of
unfaithful, he's never punished. That is true, except that he's forced to live with her.
A geisha glick
for the boy.
A one-sided deal, really, I think.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, you're right, but what are you going to do? Okay. So, all right. So, Ella, my Rava, so Rava came along with another idea. He says, Hakol hayubichla lo sovdei. All these things, right? All these various actions, right? Are included in the idea that you are not to worship idols. Okay. But when the Torah gives you a detail, gives you a statement which says that a person has to live by the mitzvah, so obviously it means he's not to die for that. So yotzo oynes, right? So in that particular case, then somebody who is forced to do something is excused, right? He's accepted to the rule, lo sovdei. The Hanukkah of Rachmon, and further, the Torah wrote another pasuk. It says, "V'lo sechalalu Hashem kodshi," right? That you are not to profane my holy name, the afila ba'oynes, which means even if you're forced to do it, you're not allowed to be machalil Hashem, to profane God. This is what I mentioned before a few moments ago about the difference between chilul Hashem and something which is done in privacy. So this is what he's explaining. He says, right, if it's done, right, where it's going to be a chilul Hashem, in other words, publicly, it's going to profane the name of God by your being forced to worship, you should not do it, right? You have to resist it, right? Okay, it's about Hobbit Sino, the Hobbit Hesia, right? One case is what you do, a case in private, the other one, what is in public. In other words, as I said, if it's in public, then you have to be prepared to give your life for whatever it may be.
Right.
But if it's private, where the world doesn't know about it, then in that particular case, if you're forced to do something, you want to save your own life. The concept of Kiddush Hashem, Chil Hashem, of course, has much broader applications. I mean, it's obvious that when a Jew does something which is brought to the attention of the public, he's a robber, cheat, whatever it may be, you know, it's these things, it is a profanation of God's name, because people expect a Jew to behave in a better way. There's no question about it. Certainly somebody who calls himself a religious Jew. And that's why it hurts us when we see, you know, that even some religious Jews unfortunately fall prey to whatever it may
what
be.
What did they do during the Spanish Inquisition?
Spanish Inquisition? Okay. So, you're absolutely right. There were Jews who offered themselves up to the Inquisition. They were burnt in public because they refused to renounce Judaism, right? There were others who they decided that they would openly avow that they were Christians, right? But practice Yiddishkeit in secret or something like that. And the problem is, of course, I mean, that those who did so, by and large, maybe for a generation or two, they might have been able to hold out, but eventually they weren't able to hold out. With some exceptions, I mean, because after all, we know also from our history that, for example, when the Jews were thrown out of Spain and Portugal, well, they had various things what to do. Some of them wound up in Africa, some of them wound up in Italy, some of them wound up in, you know, in Turkey. And eventually there were some who wound up, for example, in Holland. And in Holland, there were those who were Marranos, and they were able to throw off their cloak of being goyim, and they became Jews again.
Some of them wound up in the United States too.
Yes, yes, definitely. Because the first Jews who came to what is now the United States, they were also Marranos.
Western part of the United States.
Right.
No.
All right, so just do one or two more lines. My throat is just about ready to say bye-bye. All right, so we see the difference between Betzino, in other words, what is carried on secretly if you're forced to do something, as compared to if you have to do it openly. So, Amru l'Rabban l'Rava, so the rabbi said to Rava, Tanya Messiah Loch, we have another teaching that supports you, namely, B'mesur Shalot Kachovet B'shas HaGzeira, the pedestals of the idolaters at the time when the Roman government forced Jews, you know, to do various things. So, afal pisha gzera botla, right, even though the decree against Yiddishkeit eventually was nullified, also b'masoris le'botel. But those pedestals for the idols, they would never nullify. So that therefore, who were they yelling at? They were yelling at Ullah, who had the support of the rabbis and of Israel, but they said, we in Babylonia, we don't hold that. Okay, you did a bad thing. All right, listen.
What they say right. Pedestals, they're really talking about idols, not...
What'd you say?
Amalahu. Right, Amalahu. Right in the very middle. Go down just slightly beyond the middle of it. Amalahu. Okay?
Yeah.
All right, tonight is the 27th. I believe, of December in 2006, and we are continuing right down the middle of Avodah Zarah, over in the Dalet Amud Aleph, 54A. Okay. So they're trying to justify why one opinion says that the Bimus is permitted, another one says the Bimus is prohibited, even if it was done under force. Onus, right? In spite of the fact that we said, you know, that Achmona Onus Patre, in other words, that the Rebbeinu Shalom excuses you if, you know, you have to violate something under duress, under compulsion. I gave some other examples. As for example, I said last week that, let's say, these short days, you were so occupied with doing something that you didn't take time out to daven mincha. So there is a possibility, as a makeup, that after you daven Bayrev, then you repeat Ashrei and you say a second Shemot Esrei or something. Because if it's onus, if it's really something, you know, that you're forced to do it, or Chas v'Shalom, you're in the hospital and you're under circumstances where you cannot daven, you have to miss davening or something like that, the Rebbeinu Shalom will excuse that. Okay. Tosfos actually goes into another question. It says, in reality, if a Jew is forced to do it, even so, it should theoretically be prohibited. But the rabbis were already aware of the fact, you know, that if it's under duress, so under those circumstances, they declared that it would be permitted. All right. So, Omalu. So he said unto them, he says, Emishabab, if this is your argument, he says, Lotusayah. Now, wait a minute, no. Then I do not have, support of what you're telling me. Amor, because I could say, Yisrael Mumor Hava, that the Jew who bowed down to the Bimos, right, Ufolach Lo Berotze. So maybe he worshipped it willingly. So Rav Ashi Omar says, no, he says, lo tema Amar, don't say this way, elo vada Yisroel mumahava, ufalach bo berotze. The basic reason that even during the time when Jews were forced by the decree of the government to worship Avodah Zarah, right, that this bimos is prohibited. Why? Because it's impossible, he says, that at such a time there wouldn't be one Jew who would refuse, you know, willingly to simply go ahead and become an idolater. In other words, somebody would certainly do it simply in order to make life easier for himself or something like that, and so he did it willingly, not under compulsion. So, yeah. Pardon me?
What's the word palak?
Palak means to serve. It's the Arabic equivalent. Although in Arabic too you have it. But it's the Aramaic equivalent of avad. Right. Yeah. Matter of fact, in Eretz Israel, they use the word palaf for somebody who was a worker.
Which has some, I know it's a different word,
right.
But it also has some of those consonants.
Yeah, the first two are similar, but Hebrew works on three-letter roots.
I know.
Right, so that you have to really look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
There are people, I mean, who think that two letters are the same, so there has to be a connection. That's sort of more of a drash than it is, according to the dictum of the Hebrew language, okay. But you have to know your root of those.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So, palach in Hebrew, as I say, is really originally more like Aramaic, but then it's become also, there's that noun, palach in Hebrew. Okay, yeah. Okay. Chizki Omar, he says, Kegon shenisech labiris kechovim yayin al kodar. Now we come back to something that we spoke about even before we talked about the Pibus, because that was brought in connection, if you remember, with what? With an animal which is worshipped as an idol. Remember that? The animal is worshipped as an idol. What was the question? Question is, whether what did it become disqualified for? So, the more lenient thing that we developed is that it was disqualified for being a korban in the Beis HaMikdash. You couldn't sacrifice that animal, okay? But for ordinary purposes, you were permitted to have some use of the animal in any case, okay? So, now what the question he's asking is over here. All right, let's say that the goy could also be a Jew, Chas v'Shalom, but we're really talking more about Goyim, but it's possible, maybe a Jew. He did what? He had this animal, right? And he poured wine over it, Yayin Nesach, right? On the horns of the animal. So, what? So the question is, so does that disqualify it, or what? Right? As Rashi says, Kigon shenisech lo, right, he poured this wine as a libation, right? And she also avedes kochavim, and he performed idolatry, right? The also bar masa, all right, so that's already the next one. Okay, the next thing. All right, here all that he did is to pour wine on the horns of the animal as a libation. So the question is, does the animal become disqualified or not? This is what the question is. So Chizkiya seems to be arguing that since all that it did was to pour wine on the horns, obviously it wasn't the Baal Shevet's wine. Or not even get him. So in that particular case, right, so he didn't do anything that's so gefährlich, and therefore what? So that therefore he didn't really disqualify the animal for being used as a korban, if that's what they wanted to do with the animal. Okay, that's Chizkiya's opinion. However, we'll see. No, he attacks this idea. He says, "Hi, Devadhu." He was worshipped as the animal itself is worshipped, right? And you say, "Hi, Bimas be'alma hu v'sharye," right? You say that this is a bimos. It's used like, in other words, like a pedestal, right? That's all it is, and it's permitted to use. In other words, it's permitted even for sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash. No, says I say, Kigol shenisech lo yayim ben karneho, the omad bo masa. He poured it between the horns, so that was on the head of the animal, and he worshipped it at that particular point. So in that particular case, how does the animal, is the animal permitted or not permitted? Obviously the animal is disqualified, because then he already did something that was a real action. Once the action of worshipping it, then in that particular case, no good. Okay. Well, some of these things that seem to us, I mean, a little bit on the far-fetched side, I have to admit. But nevertheless, we weren't living in those days, you know. We weren't living in those days when idolatry was so rampant. And the people did all kinds of sugar things. Right.
In some cases, they were trying to make fun of each other.
Well, there's no question. Yeah. You know, your question raises an interesting idea in my own mind, in that it seems to me that there are really two strands. Strand number one is Taka, they don't believe in the idols and they want to make them look ridiculous. This is correct. Okay? But we find that going back even to the days of Yeshayahu, for example, he also, you know, or even Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, talking about the idols, you know, that he says, where are your idols? Yokumi Azruchem, yeah, let them rise up and help you, right? Let them be protection for you and so on. So it's a garish to me, you know, that there's no value whatever in them. That's number one, attacking the validity of idols. But the other one is the fact that they have to combat idolatry in order to make sure that Jews should not be enticed into idol worship, and what would be the result if the Taka were enticed into idolatry. You understand? So that you're really faced with these two different thoughts in what we're learning over here.
Well,
Sylvia,
it
yeah.
It brings up the question in my mind. They are discussing the finer points of law.
Right,
so
right. Yeah.
How does the populace know what the rules are?
Well, that's a good question. All right.
In other words, it's all very well for them to be discussing what
yeah.
you can do or not
right,
do, or
right.
you use it or can't use it. But how about the farmer there that owns the animal? Does he know the fine point, and how did he get to know it?
The answer is that you have to have people who teach these things to them. Whether they teach them, they teach them in the shul, they teach them in conversation. They teach them in schools if they have, right, and so on. Definitely, right.
For the populace.
Right.
So that's why education,
yeah.
you know, is like a necessity. Like
absolutely. Look.
You can't survive without...
In reality...
Jews without the education.
And that's just as true today as it was in those days. Right, just as true.
Even worse.
Right.
Right.
Right. And when we see, unfortunately, Jews who are absolutely, totally ignorant of any phase of Yiddishkeit, they have no feeling, no desire to learn, no nothing. I mean, it's terrible. And unfortunately, this is true also of secularists in Eretz Yisrael, to whom religion became anathema, you know. They prefer to be socialists or communists and not to be Jews. Right.
So they may at least
secularism.
Have some, at least one of the generations they have some understanding.
That was a generation that grew up in Europe and came to Eretz Israel. All right,
but
correct.
The next generation,
but as the generations
the next generation
went on,
very
I mean,
secular.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
They talk about the Bible as being their geography book and their history book, because they know it. Through the secular connotation.
Right.
Two separate articles, the Sunday New York Times, Sunday Times.
Yeah.
One was the Jewish families observing
Christmas. Uh huh.
Yeah, well, that was a big thing, the forward.
And, you know, and they make it sound like it's perfectly normal.
Right.
It's enough to make it so
very, very.
You read it. I mean, these are intelligent, articulate people.
The forward carried such a...
Unfortunately, right. Very unfortunate.
And they see nothing wrong with...
Yeah.
They see it as an accommodation to the new generation of Jews in America. This is that comes from the mixed...
They
don't understand
how they make themselves.
Of course.
It's an ecumenical...
Yeah, well, I mean, you can carry ecumenical.
It's an ecumenical idea.
Yes, but you can carry ecumenical up to a certain point. I mean, obviously, you want to cooperate with other religions and so on and so forth in order to make this a better world. This is right.
But
right, right.
Well, this is necessary because there are mixed marriages. They are accommodating.
They feel they have to accommodate
yeah.
different traditions.
Yeah, that's why
the
Menorah or something or other, place, I don't know what. I haven't seen them, but...
My son was telling me about, down south, about evidently more than one family has been decorating their houses with the blue and white lights.
Yeah.
In celebration of the season.
Yeah.
So they should not have not have lights. And I told them I thought it was so terrible. Yeah.
Instead of a menorah, they decorate with blue and white lights. So okay.
Yeah, blue and white lights.
Right, right.
That not only was it not was a tacky, but it wasn't Jewish.
Ah, okay, so we're not, it's not so far to think about an animal being served as an idol or something like that.
Yeah, so
Stuss, I'm telling you, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, for me too.
Alright. Okay, let's continue with the Gemara text. All right. V'chihod also Ula. And likewise, along came Ula. When it says also he came, it means he came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia to tell them, you know, what they're discussing in the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, right? So Omar Rabbi Yochanan reported what Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael was saying. He said, Afal pi she omru even though we learned before that if somebody bows down to the idol of another person, he did not make it prohibited simply because we said that you cannot prohibit something that doesn't belong to you, has to belong to belongs to somebody else. But nevertheless, right, Amaluhu Rab Nachman, right? So Rab Nachman said it's also by Matzah, right? So he did, nevertheless, by the very fact, you know, that he worshipped it, he's done something tangible. It's not something that's intangible, right? And therefore, Asura, okay? Therefore, he made the animal. So, contrary to what we learned before, that he didn't render it, you know, prohibited as a sacrifice, but Rabbi Yochanan felt that if the animal was actually worshipped, even though it was not his own, nevertheless, the animal is now prohibited to be served as a sacrifice. So, Amalu Rab Nachman. So, Rab Nachman said to the people in Babylonian, his yeshiva, he said, Puku v'yimru leili Ula, go out, tell Ula, Kvar tigamar Rav Huna l'shmatich, that Rav Huna here in Babylonia already has said something along these lines even before you came to tell us the spices. Okay, shmatich we bought it. Namely, the Omar Rav Huna, as Rav Huna said, Hoyeso behemas chaveiro revutza b'fnei avidus kechavim, if the animal of some other person was lying down, was crouching down over there before an idol, kevin sheshachat po siman echad asura. So if he came along and he cut even one of the vital organs of the animal, he made it all there, which was, in other words, of the animal which was there in front of the idol, it's as though he was doing what to the animal? Sacrificing it. So asura. Then in that particular case, he already made it prohibited, okay, to be used as a sacrifice. When it says Simon Echad, you have to know, Simon refers in this particular case either to the jugular vein or to the esophagus. Okay, now an animal, we all have it, we have jugular vein, we have esophagus, okay. When you shecht an animal, the sheath of the knife has to cut through both simanim for it to be a kosher shechita. I mean, besides all the other rules and regulations that you have concerning it, okay? With a chicken, one siman is enough. With a fowl, okay? But with an animal, it has to go through both simanim. I mean, of course, I don't have to tell you, a shechit has to know exactly how to do this. And he has to be tested, you know, in order to make sure that the shechita, you know, it is kosher, right? Right. Yeah. Yes.
The jugular vein, I understand, but it's not the windpipe; it's the esophagus.
Well, either the windpipe or the esophagus. There are two of them, right? So both of them have to be cut simultaneously when he cuts right through them. Right.
Simon,
yeah.
Is the same word as sign?
Yes, but in this particular case, why do they use the word simon for it? So the answer is because this is a sign testing whether the animal was slaughtered in a kosher fashion. So they use the word simon for it. So simon echod or shnei simonim and so on. Okay. Minola da Asura. So how do we know that it is prohibited, that he made it prohibited? Ilemo mikehadim, if we say we learned this from priests, what priests are we talking about? So we have to go back to Rashi. Now Rashi explains that what happened was that the kings of Israel, when, of course, by Israel I mean in this particular case the northern kingdom, okay, when Yerovim ben Nevat created his temples in the north, what in Bethel, what in Dan, if you remember, and he set up calves over there, Agalim, reminds us of the golden calf, right? And they set up these Agalim over there, that they were supposed to be representatives of Hashem or something like that. And then eventually, of course, they even had pagan business. But at any rate, they had Kohanim who were living over there, right? And they were forced to do what? They were forced to serve in these temples. Okay? So now we're coming now back again to the business about force. In this particular case, shall we say that inasmuch as the kings forced these Kohanim to serve Avodah Zarah, so were they qualified once, you know, if they wanted, let's say, to come back to the Beis HaMikdash and serve over there, would they be considered as valid Kohanim? So in Yechezkel we find that he says no, those who served previously were no longer qualified to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, they were Kohanim, but they were not qualified to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Only the people who are Kohanim, Halviyim, B'nei Tzadok, it happens to be in the beginning of Haftorah, if you remember, for Parsha Emor, okay? Where he talks. Emor, if you remember, deals with, at the beginning, with who is a qualified priest in the Torah, and so the Haftorah naturally matches it also by Yechezkel. So Yechezkel said they were disqualified from serving in the Beis HaMikdash. Only those of B'nei Tzadok, Asher Shabbos Mishmeres Hashem, they were the ones who remained loyal to God. They were the ones, you know, who were permitted to go into the servant. And we know, of course, that the Kohanim had what they did. They had a business. As a matter of fact, we may come across an allusion. No, not over here, but there are allusions in other Gemaras to the business of Kohanim. In other words, that they had a business in order to check upon the fact who was qualified, who was not qualified, who had the yichus, and who did not have the proper yichus in order to serve. So they were very particular, you know, about who they wanted to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So the point is over here, if we say that the disqualification of this animal which was served is similar to the disqualification of the Kohanim who had served Avodah Zarah, and therefore they were now disqualified. So he says, no. V'dil meshadei kahanim b'nei da'edeyot ninu. Maybe we can't make an exact comparison between kahanim and animals. Why? Because kahanim are b'nei da'edeyot. They have intelligence. They can think. So it's a different story as compared to an animal which doesn't think, right? So the elot me avne mizbeach. So maybe our comparison should be with the stones of the altar in the Beis HaMikdash. What did we learn about them? We learned what happened when the Greeks came into the Beis HaMikdash and they turned the altar of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam into an altar for Avodah Zarah. And then when the Maccabees came and they were able to cleanse the temple, the Chashmonaim, Maccabees, whatever you want to call them, what did they do with this altar? So the answer is, remember, it was made of stones. So they took the stones and they buried them. They buried them. So again, why did they bury them? Because once it had been disqualified, then it's not proper, it's not fit for the Beis HaMikdash.
That means
right.
They had to provide new stones for the new
right,
altar.
Right, correct.
At that time.
Right, exactly, right, yeah. V'dilma kara papa, and maybe it's a different comparison. Maybe it's a different we're ready for the next page over there, which would be Nundalat Omid Beis, right? It says, maybe it's like Rav Papa. As Rashi explains what is Rav Papa, he says, the Omar, he says, they found a Pasek, he says, Vidorish. And they interpreted this Pasek to say, Sheyetsu Nuchulin, that they would become chulad. Chulad means, you know, they lose their holiness, right? Uknoom ha'evde kechavim v'yochlu li'osron. And as a result, the ha'evde kechavim, since they were no longer holy, then the goyim would acquire them, and in that case they could prohibit them. At any rate, I mean, it's a question, so which one is the closest to, but it's not really that relevant. Okay, the Elor, but rather he says, let's make a comparison. Mikalim, what about Caleb? So Kalim, of course, means all kinds of implements, as for example, cups, saucers, knives, forks, and so on. And in the Mizbeach, don't forget, also they had to have forks and knives and censers, and the Chavetz was talking, and they had all kinds of things that they needed, right? For the libations and for the sacrifices and so on. They needed pots in order to cook, let's say, the sacrifice, so that the Kahanim could eat them. And they needed things for the wine neser, and they needed bowls in order to make the menochos, you know, the meal offerings, etc., etc. Okay, so they needed all kinds of things in Beis HaMikdash. Matter of fact, there is a museum in Yerushalayim which is dedicated to showing you all these different things that existed in the time of the Beis HaMikdash.
Where is
this? In Yerushalayim, they have such a museum, right?
Wait, are these the people, like Yerushalayim,
Sholem,
are these the people that are trying to make a
table
for the third
Beit HaMikdash? There are people who are doing it now, that's correct.
This is different.
But I say there is, right, yeah. So at any rate, what about Caleb? So he says, there's a pasuk that says, and this happens to be in the book of Divrei HaYomim, in other words, Chronicles, it says, V'yes kol ha-kelim asher hizniach ha-melech ochaz v'malchusei v'ma'alo, all the kelim that King Ochaz, who was attracted to idolatry, he defiled them, because what did he do? He used them for Avodah Zorah, right? During the time that he was king, v'ma'alo, when he sinned, hechano v'hikdashnu. So we prepared them and we sanctified them. The Yomamar and one of the teachers explained these two words, Hechanu. How did we prepare them? We prepared them, She'genozu. We buried them so that they should never again be used. The Hikdashtu, and we sanctified them. How did we sanctify? She'genozu acherim taftehen. We sanctified other Kalim in their place. Okay. So now they come back to a question that we raised earlier. But how can a person make prohibited something that doesn't belong to him?
So
we're talking about behemoth chaviro, behemoth chaviro. Okay, it's not he bowed down to his own animal. That's already the question. He uses the body, but he bowed down to the animal that belongs to somebody else. And the question that was raised, remember, the original statement was that he did not therefore disqualify the animal because he had no right.
Right, I understand that.
All right. Then along came this discussion of the Rav Huna and so on that was quoted in Babylonia to say that, no, on the contrary, it made it prohibited because the very fact that whatever was done, it was an act of Avodah Zorah. So now they come back to this question. How could you say that if you say that you cannot disqualify something that doesn't belong to you, that belongs to somebody else?
Right. I understand that. Right. They have this discussion, maybe, I guess I'm not following this. They have a discussion where they first brought up, we're talking about the animal.
Right.
Okay, and actually the last thing was that somebody had made a cut in the animal.
Yeah,
they bring in
which is already an action that they deserve. Okay.
Bring in the Kohanim.
Right.
They bring in the stones.
Right. To show that even once it had been used for Avodah Zorah, right? So what are you going to do with it? So most of the opinion said, bury it, can't use it anymore, it's no good. So obviously, coming back to the animal that belonged to somebody else, how could they come and say that it would be still permitted to be used as a sacrifice?
Right. The only way
to
kill
the
animal
is
to
substitute. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Right. Okay.
They make the comparison at the highest level, like Kohanim and the Kalim of the
year. Right.
They submit the to indicate that even at that level, they made it. It could not be used.
It could not be used, right.
So if it can't be surely for a lesser thing.
Right, right. So Ella, but Kaven the Ovad Behu, Masa Israelahu. We learned that the moment that you do something, a real action with it, automatically it becomes prohibited, right? So Ochanami, so here too. Kaven she'osah b'masa asura. Once, you know, you perform something with it, with this animal, as we said, you know, like cutting the throat, according to the last opinion, or to earlier opinions that use it as a sacrifice, whatever the one. That is, you pour, you know, a sacrificial wine over it, this and this, and so on. So, you did something. Kiyosah Rab Dimi, when Rab Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael, so Abba Rabbi Yochanan, so again he quotes Rabbi Yochanan, another teaching of his, that Afa Pisha Amru, even though they said Hamishtachaveh Lekarka Olam No Asoro, this we had way back quite a few weeks ago, that if a person bows down to the earth, to the ground, right, he does not, and worships it, but he did not make the earth Avedazari, you understand? In other words, he does not make it prohibited for all our use that we need the earth for. Okay? Because we say it's Karka Olam, right? It belongs to the whole world. Okay. So, but Chafabra Boros Shechid Boros Asura. But if he did something specifically in the ground and then used it as a, let's say, like a chamber to worship in, then in that case he made it prohibited. Boros, a bor is a well that you dig, right? Shechid is like